afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Excuse me. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. When you're listening to the live program, it means that you can call in and be a part of it as well. If you have a question about the Bible, you disagree with the host on some subject, would like to bring up an alternate viewpoint, you're more than welcome to do that in the coming hour. You'll need only a telephone and a little bit of time. And some of that time might be used waiting online while I talk to somebody else. But if you've got the time, I'm paying for the airtime. You just and I'll even pay for your phone call. So you just have to put out the time. I'll put out all the money. Of course, when I talk about money, none of the money is mine anyway. All the money comes from listeners, maybe even from you. But once it's there, once the bill's been paid, we have the radio time. Everything's free for you. To get on with us. We've got calls waiting from Seattle, Washington, Littleton, Colorado, and we've got some places at the table with your name tag on it if you want to give me a call to show up. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Be glad to talk to you in this coming hour together. We'll first talk to Dan, who's calling from Seattle. Dan, welcome to the Narrow Path, and thank you for your call.
Well, hi there, Steve. How are you?
Excellent.
Good. I have to thank you. To add to your list of credits, you are partly responsible for me losing 50 pounds over the last couple of years.
Why, were you trying to imitate my physique? Is that it?
Exactly. Yeah. No.
I'm so much into listening to MP3s, you forgot to eat.
That you're getting closer. What happened is I downloaded your show off of iTunes, and it invaded my iPod to the extent I had 2 years of your programs, and I used you to keep me running on the treadmill. So while others are, you know, listening to Rocky music or whatever they do when they run, I'm listening to the Narrow Path, so keeps me running.
So your bodily exercise profits a little, and you're listening to the Narrow Path profits hopefully even more so.
Well, yeah, and I've been listening to you since I would say about 94 or 95 when you were out in on a station out of Albany, Oregon, when I lived in Salem.
Yeah, I lived in McMinnville then.
And I haven't had the occasion to call you because, oddly enough, we typically, well, I would say unabashedly agree most all the time. So, and that's kind of odd because I draw
There's got to be something wrong with you.
Yeah. Well, not to take up any more of your time. I just want to get your opinion on a couple situations, and this is something that may not really mean anything in the whole sense of things, but one thing, and they're both kind of related, is I'll start with the first issue, and then I'll actually take your comments off the air because my cell phone's going to run out of batteries.
Okay.
The first situation is my father, he passed away about going on 11 years ago, and he was in intensive care for about 21 days, and at one point, someone from the hospital had called us and said to come on in because my dad was dying. And I have to start by saying I'm very I don't jump at supernatural things very easily. I take them with a grain of salt, so I'm not one that would be really exposed to these types of things. I want to get your opinion. But when I showed up at the hospital, the doctor said he had passed away. And then someone came out and said, no, he's back among the living again. So I went in to see him, and he came to, and he said he told me himself that he had died, and that when that had happened, he was greeted by someone who didn't present himself as Jesus, if you would, but he said that in all intents and purposes, he felt like that was him, and he got the impression. And he was in a place of pure warmth and just all good and love, and that the person, he told the person that he wanted to live, and I asked him, what did the person say? Well, he said, I wanted to live, and he said, why? And he said, because I needed to be there for my boys, which would be my brother and myself, that he didn't feel we were ready to be without our father on the earth, that is. And he said, And I asked him, what did he say to that? He said, well, he said, that's understandable. And then he said he woke, like you hear a lot of times people say, he woke up and he was back in severe pain and gasping for breath and came to. And, of course, long story short, I asked him, you know, why he would have wanted to live because his death was pretty imminent. He was in no shape to really make a full recovery. And he said, Well, he felt if he could live for a while longer to be with us, that'd be good. However, the place that he had been to was so much more peaceful. So I want to get your take on that whole thing and you know, just not so much, you know, does those things happen, but how you would take it.
Yeah, well, I take a story like that at face value. There's a lot of people who've felt that they've seen Jesus just before they died or even after death, and they've come back. Some friends of mine that I knew for many years, the wife actually collapsed in the bathroom with a tubal pregnancy that she didn't know she had, and she had no vital signs. By the time she got to the hospital, she was said to be dead. But in the hospital, she came back, and she had a very similar story to that. She said that she had seen Jesus, and she, you know, enjoyed being in his presence, but she felt badly because she had, I think, 3 or 4 little children who were not raised yet, and she asked if she could, you know, raise them. And she came back to life again in the hospital. I mean, this is something that someone very close to me this happened to, and I heard her story from her own mouth. Now, I don't, you know, I can't say that those kind of stories don't reflect, you know, something delusional. I mean, when there's no vital signs, we assume a person is dead and their spirit has left their body, but we really don't know. You know, once all the vital signs are gone, we just don't know what's going on in there. And maybe a brain that's deprived of oxygen has hallucinations or something. I'm trying to think of what a materialist might say about these things. Right. I have no trouble accepting them at face value because I believe in Jesus and I believe that when people die, they will face him. And I can't say for sure that he won't give them, you know, a reprieve to come back. He did for a few people who died during his earthly sojourn here, Jairus' daughter, for example, and Lazarus and so forth. But, you know, it's not very common. But this is your father. Was he a Christian man before this incident?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, I mean, well, that strikes me as something that I don't have any trouble accepting at face value.
Right. And I mean, a lot of people say what would be the purpose. And I think a lot of people, you know, that had heard the story, one of the comments he made was the suffering that he faced was alleviated by the fact he seen what lied ahead. I think a lot of people, I heard comments after saying, you know, the peace that passes understanding, you know, is something that they'd like to see in their life, you know, whether it be physical struggle or whether it be struggle with sin or debt or whatever it may be, that as Christians we face a time of peace, you know, that someone even in the midst of being on a ventilator would say, you know, I'd rather be in this other stage, you know, than be here on the ventilator. So there was some good from it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there was, not only to your father, but to those who heard the story. I mean, who knows how many people may benefit in their time of dying to remember this story if they take it seriously, you know. I mean,
right.
I had my paternal grandfather, I don't remember him being a very religious man. He certainly believed in God, and I believe he believed in Jesus. I think he had a Christian upbringing. I'm not positive. But he was, I'm sure, a Bible believer, though he didn't seem to know that much about the Bible when I talked to him. But when he was dying of lung cancer, he was in the hospital, and I didn't see this happen, but family members, I think, were present when this happened. And he was kind of delirious in his hospital bed, and then he thought he saw Jesus, and then he died. He thought he saw Jesus in the room, and as I recall,
wow.
I don't remember which of my relatives were in the room. I don't think my father was, but anyway, I do remember hearing that my grandfather said, "Oh, there's Jesus right there." And I think Billy Graham said that someone related his mother or someone, her last word, she had been in a coma or something before she died, and just as she was dying, she woke up and said, "Oh, there's Jesus," and then she was gone. You know, I mean, so.
Right.
These are anecdotal stories. You know, you can't prove anything by them. But there's no innate reason to be suspicious of them.
Right. Okay, one other thing, because I know people are waiting and we need to move on. This is hits a little closer to home, and I don't know how to take this other than, you know, just a standard dream with a coincidence, but maybe you can give some thought of, say, in the same realm of your answer. The other question would be, I personally, with my first child, we have 3 children, just before my first child was born, I was sleeping, and I had a dream that I went into his nursery. And in there, I was met by this being, let's take it. And again, you got to understand, I don't buy into this stuff, and I don't really have, I have a hard time believing when people say these things. But this being exuded this feeling of pure absence of love, and actually pure hatred. And what I got from him was that he wished that, you know, absolutely the worst for me that you could possibly wish without saying words. And but at that point, I said to him, you know, in the name of Jesus, you need to leave, you know. And I prayed, and he looked at me with even utter disgust and said, "How you have no powers of this, for you have no Lord in you." He says, "You don't have the power to rebuke," because, and then he was almost taunting, and then he looked as he was fleeing, kind of, and he says, "Your son will be born with an impairment to his leg." And he said, "He will, that'll be a sign of this time," and just vanished. And I woke up, and I actually prayed to the Lord for I felt, you know, Lord, I shouldn't be dreaming things like that. Why would I dream that? You know, I'm sorry if there's something, if there's sin in my life, you know, that I need to, I took it as, you know, maybe I'm feeling guilty over some sin that I was doing, and maybe had I been in a situation that, you know, the Lord wouldn't have been with me. However, you know, I was not knowing of any apparent sin. However, you know, I let it pass and pass as a dream, and I had mentioned it to my wife, though, because I was so startled from it. It was one of those dreams that are very livid. And I said, you know, I dreamed this, and she didn't even want to hear anything about it. Well, he was born, and he came out with a very bad his foot had been kind of pinned up against his calf, if you would.
And
the good thing is we were able to over about 3 or 4 months through massage and things like that. It's perfectly fine. He's perfectly fine now. But he was born with a situation, had we not fixed it, that he wouldn't have walked. And all this obviously can be complete coincidence. However, it's always been with me, and I've always thought, I wonder, you know, if anybody would have any insight to this, or, you know, I don't believe personally anyone would have power to do something like that other than the Lord's will, but I would just get your insight on that.
Okay, all this was a dream you had, right?
Oh, yeah, and I would say it was nothing more, because, again, I'm not one to jump at, you know, things like this, but this was a dream, and in my opinion, it's a vivid dream, though, very vivid.
Yeah, I'd be glad to give you some thoughts about that. Now, did you actually want to get off the phone? You had said,
well,
you wanted to stay on with us.
I had said that, Steve, but I just remembered I'm not in one of your service areas. So what I'll do is I'll stay on, and if my phone goes dead, you'll know why.
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, dreams are funny things, and I think they can come from a lot of different sources. I think they can come from our own imaginations, and of course, Freudians would say they come from our subconscious or something. I don't necessarily follow Freudian ideas, but I think they can come from God, and they can come from the devil. Now, it seems to me that there was actually, I mean, I would be at least willing to accept as a postulate that this was a dream that the devil brought to bring condemnation, to bring accusation to you. I mean, certainly from talking to you, it sounds like you're a genuine Christian, and therefore the being that said that you don't have God in you is wrong, and the being did leave. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was a fleeing. It was like he was leaving as he was saying, you know, basically, you know, take that, you know, or whatever. Not
that
he cast it, but the idea was, you'll remember this because of this situation.
Yeah, and that's just basically, I think, the devil trying to make you feel condemned. I've known a number of Christians who have bad dreams frequently, which seem to be demonic. I mean, they are accusatory dreams. It makes them wake up wondering about their salvation and things like that, when there's really no reason during their waking hours to wonder about their sincerity or anything like that. I mean, the devil is the accuser of the brethren, and I'm sure he could use a dream like that to really get you to start wondering. The fact that the being actually, as you say, left, even though it said that you didn't have the power to make it go, suggests to me that it was a lying being. It had to go, apparently. And I'm not an interpreter of dreams. I'm just trying to interpret the experience, you know, the experience itself, not the dream. But it strikes me as it's from that would be from the enemy, just trying to get you to think that you have no power. You know, I have known of cases. I have not had this experience myself, but I've known of cases of people who were dealing with demon-possessed people and telling the demons to leave, and having the demons tell them things like that. You can't cast me out. In one case, a demon said to the man who's trying to cast out, says, you can't cast me out because I'm the kind that only comes up by prayer and fasting, and you haven't fasted. And the man said, well, he says, I haven't fasted, but he says, Jesus has fasted, and he's the one who's casting you out, not me. And the demon, as the story goes, did in fact leave. But I've heard of many cases where the demons tried to tell the Christian, you can't cast me out, I belong here. But I've never heard really of a case where when the Christian persisted that the demon really was able to dig in his heels and stay against the name of Jesus. Demons often, you know, lie. I mean, that's what they're up to a lot of the time. And one of the lies they like to tell you is that you can't do anything to them when, in fact, you can.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, it was a time where I've never sensed such I reflect on it as an absence of any light or love in a situation where the absence of love was so apparent that it came as just a total sense of anger and animosity without even having that present, just as a person being in the same room.
Yeah. Well, so Dan, I'd love to talk to you more about this.
Yes.
We do need to move along, but I appreciate you calling and sharing those things.
Well, thanks, Steve, and I appreciate your work. It served me very well, and I know it helps pursue, you know, what the Lord has us to do in this world.
Good. God bless you, brother.
Okay, God bless you. Bye.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is Brad from Littleton, Colorado. We have lines open for you also at 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Now, I do want to say this, that a call like that is, I'm just, my instincts tell me, could easily influence a lot of people to call up with similar stories. Oh, I have one of those too. You know, that happened to me too. I'm not necessarily inviting those. Not that I'm against someone calling once in a while and sharing something like that, especially when they're trying to get some clarity about it. But I happen to know that among the people listening, there are probably many who have had dreams or demonic experiences or things like that, that they would say, you know, when they hear a story like that last call, they would say, oh, yeah, that reminds me of what happened to me. I think I'll call and tell about it. I don't know that we need to hear a lot of stories like that necessarily. I mean, not that I'm forbidding them. Of course, the program is primarily to assist you if you have questions or assist our listeners if there's something that's been misleading that I've said on the program and you can set the record straight. Give me a call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Brad, thanks for waiting so long.
Oh, no problem. My question's on, well, I got a couple if you have time, but one on Romans 5:16.
Okay.
And I was reading this to my son last night, and I couldn't figure it out at all myself. I don't even remember it being that confusing.
It's a jumble. It's a verbal jumble. Not okay. Jungle. Jumble.
Okay, well, the part that gets me is, everything makes up sense up until it looks like it's the first comma. I'm looking in New King James, but then it says, "But the free gift, which is the gift of salvation or the gift on the cross, which came from many offenses, resulted in justification." Why would the free gift come from many offenses?
Yeah, I think most commentators would say that that wording is not as helpful as it could be. That what Paul is contrasting is that the condemnation that came through one man's single act, you know, the condemnation Adam brought,
right,
was a result of a single sin, and whereas Jesus' justification that he brought, the righteousness he brought, is greater than the condemnation in that it covers a multitude of sins. It comes after. I know it says that it was from
resulted
many
from
offenses. Him. Yeah, resulted from or whatever. We could say that the reason that God sent Jesus was because of the many sins that people had committed, and therefore there's a sense in which it was a result of the condition that man had fallen into with his many sins.
So it came, but
it's an awkward
meaning.
Yeah, it's an awkward wording, and everything in this whole section of Romans 5 is awkward. I mean, Paul is trying to make comparisons and contrasts between what Adam brought on the human race and what Jesus brought. Sometimes he's comparing it, sometimes he's contrasting it. And Paul himself seems to be having a difficult time explaining what he means, because the section is constructed strangely. It's got a lengthy parenthesis,
yeah.
And a smaller parenthesis inside of the long parenthesis. I mean, like he's really going off on rabbit trails, it seems to me. And it makes it difficult to follow his train of thought. And so I actually heard one, I always found it to be so. I always found this section of Romans 5 to be very difficult, not to accept Paul's teaching, but to understand what he's trying to say, because his words are all mixed up in some ways. And I was thinking there was something wrong with me until once I heard one of my favorite teachers, teaching through Romans, and he came to us, he said, now this is one of the most difficult passages, you know, to follow Paul's train of thought in the, all of Paul's writings. So I thought, well, maybe it's not just me. So I've concluded it's a problem in that I think Paul was trying to get across something that's rather deep, and we might even say esoteric truth that I think he was having a hard time finding the right words to get it across to his audience. I know the phenomenon. I've had times when I felt like I understood something that was rather deep, and I knew I didn't have the words, or didn't know how to put the sentences together to get it across to someone else the way I was seeing it. And I frankly think Paul was having a difficulty expressing himself here.
Yeah. It's kind of funny reading it to my 7-year-old, and I'm having a really hard time. Eventually I just have to say, I think this is what it means overall, and it's just kind of just like, distrust me.
I would be very surprised to find any intelligent reader reading that last half of Romans 5 and finding nothing difficult about following it.
Okay.
Anyway, I think Paul's point, I've always felt that Paul's point is, and I'm not even sure what the great significance of the point
right.
is.
Right, that's what gets me, that's what got me. It's not that hard of a, overall it doesn't seem.
Yeah, overall he's pointing out that what Jesus accomplished is even greater in redeeming man than what Adam accomplished in condemning man. I mean, both effects came on humanity through the acts of individual men. One act of Adam, you know, brought disaster on the human race, and one act, I think Paul's thinking of the crucifixion of Christ, or he may be thinking of the whole righteous life of Christ, but one act of one man, Jesus, brought redemption to man, and forgiveness and justification and all that. But he doesn't want us to think that Adam and Christ are, you know, exact equals, because Christ is so superior to Adam, and what Christ accomplished is so superior. Christ is mightier in redeeming humanity than Adam was in condemning humanity. And so he's trying to make these contrasts. And this one you bring up, I've always felt like what Paul's trying to say is, you know, Adam's condemnation was only the result of a single sin.
Right.
But Christ's redemption had to cover multitudes of sins, which makes his condemnation, you know, the more potent or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But it's difficult. It's very difficult to follow Paul's line of thinking there.
Okay. Then another one would be, I'm listening through, I don't know, Samuel or Kings. I just go back and forth, get completely confused. One of the two.
Uh-huh.
And you were commenting on Shimei and how...
That'd be Samuel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Unless it's his death in 1 Kings.
Yeah, it's in Kings. So it's in Kings,
okay.
1 Kings 2, I
okay.
think, or 2 Kings. Yeah, 1 Kings 2.
Yeah, okay.
So Shimei, Solomon ended up executing Shimei, and your comment was that Shimei had deserved such, but your reasoning was basically, well, it seemed to me that it was based on, well, that's, I mean, come on, you don't insult a king, much less throw rocks at him. And but I couldn't see anything. I mean, he seems like a big, major jerk, but I couldn't see that he did anything deserving of death, at least according to God's law.
Well, I think treason, God's law never deals with the subject of treason.
Right.
Because Moses set up the system where there was no such thing as a king. He predicted in the book of Deuteronomy that they would eventually have a king, but he didn't really legislate,
rules
political rules and things like that, you know, I mean, and how people would be punished. In every society, a person who's, rebelling against the country and undermining it and even opposing the king in a way that is like Shimei was doing. I mean, Shimei was cursing the king, throwing rocks at the king and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that people get their heads lopped off for. And frankly, even if it wasn't the case that God had said such people should die, any citizen of any kingdom would know that he's asking for that. I mean, it'd be in any society that has kings, knows that kings just don't put up with that kind of treatment, but David did.
But
David was not in the killing mood at that day, you know.
God's king was supposed to be different from all the other kings, isn't that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so you're saying the treason is kind of implicit, that God didn't really, you know, feel the need to outline such political details, but they're just kind of generally accepted, maybe?
Well, right. Now let me say this. I could be wrong in assuming that God favors the capital punishment for treason. Maybe God doesn't see it that way. God says nothing about it for or against, as
right.
far as I can tell. But it was universally understood law in all monarchies. You know, you curse the king to his face and throw rocks at him, you're just asking for his bodyguards to come and lop your head off. You know, I mean, that's, Shimei was asking for it. It may be that some of the laws that the kingdom followed of executing traitors and things like that are not specifically forbidden in the law of Moses, and maybe one could argue that God wouldn't be favorable toward it. But that, whether God was favorable toward that or not, that's the way a man, when he behaved that way, was asking to be treated, because that's how kings treat their, that's how king treat traitors. I mean, you know, Ahithophel, David's counselor, as soon as he knew, when his counsel was rejected,
right.
and I think he went and hanged himself. I think he hanged himself because he knew that his counsel to Absalom was wise and would have resulted in Absalom's victory, but because his counsel was rejected by Absalom, David was going to come back to power, and of course Ahithophel would be killed as a traitor. And so he said, that's not going to happen to me, and he went and killed himself, hanged himself. But, I mean, that's just the intrigues of political, you know, reality. I don't know that the law of Moses addressed, you know, the pros and cons of, you know, how to treat traitors. But once you, because I say the law of Moses was written to a people who didn't have kings and really shouldn't have had kings and didn't for about 480 years after the law was given. But once they had a monarch, it's sort of like, I think, in my opinion, general political laws such as govern monarchies probably were assumed to be you know, followed, as long as they're not barbaric or not unjust. But that's the question, I guess, is killing a man for cursing and throwing rocks at the king, is that unjust? I guess one would be entitled to have a different opinion than me about it, but I think that was a penalty that that any man could have expected if they treated a king that way.
Right. Okay. Do you have more callers, or is there time for another one?
Yeah, my lines are actually full.
Oh, okay. I'll call in another time then.
Well, okay. Was there another one on the same subject?
It would have been more. It would have been longer. That one.
Oh, okay.
I'll try.
Well, why don't you get back to me about it?
Okay.
Okay, Brad.
All right. Thanks.
God bless you. Bye bye.
You too. Bye bye.
All right. We're gonna talk next to Sharon from Eugene, Oregon. And our lines are not full now that Brad's finished here. And if you, I'm sorry, his line just got taken. So I won't give the number out. We'll talk to Sharon in Eugene, Oregon next. Hi,
Hello.
Sharon.
Hello. I'm calling to say, and I know that you shared that you had some suffering or affliction in your life and in marriage or whatever. And I am at a point in my life and I'm trying to see how to value the suffering that I'm dealing with and how to go on and not just say I give up.
Yeah, in your marriage.
Well, I've dealt with divorce and I've dealt with it twice, and I guess I've been I married the wrong kind of guys. You know, I married people that were placators, you know.
And so when I got your divorce now.
Home, yeah, and when I got those babies home, it was like a massacre, what they inflicted on me. Mm-hmm. And just to deal with 21 years of, after the first marriage, I didn't want to get married for 15 years. And then after the second one, it took me 6 years to recover. So I, at that recovery stage of the last marriage, and just looking, you know, at 57 years old, you say, well, has my life mattered? Have I accomplished anything? And then I had one daughter, and she's just gone the opposite direction of Christianity. And I've just been waiting on God, when will she turn around? And I heard this statement, to see things in light of eternity. You know, and I'm looking at my life, and I'm saying, how do I, you know, justify all the pain, all the grief that I've been through, and how can the Lord, you know, make good over the garbage that I've had to tolerate?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the
and
fact
I'm going to get
matter,
off the line, and I'm just going to listen.
Okay. Now, but you're asking me how do you deal with the pain, or how do you...
How do you resolve it? How do you file it away in your system, in your mental makeup, so that you can just say, I can go on. You know, I can move on this. Because, you know, I think you said that you were divorced and you were left with five kids, and how you resolve, you know, I want to hear how you resolved it and how you're able to go on after your heartache.
But, yeah, but before you go, let me ask you, how long have you been a Christian? Have you been a Christian most of your life?
Well, I since I was 14, but let's say 13 years of being backslidden and a family that persecuted me because I became a Christian.
Yeah. Okay.
So Christianity is not something that's been handed on a platter to me.
Yeah. Well, that's a piece of the puzzle that makes that significant, too. Well, yeah, I'll be glad to talk about that a little bit.
Thanks a lot.
God bless you, Sharon. Okay, well, as a matter of fact, I have been through some difficulties in marriage. My first wife I married when I was 19. The marriage only lasted 2 years. My wife was a serial adulteress in the marriage and then ran off and left me with a baby that was 1 year old, and I raised that baby. Some years later, 6 years later, I married again. My second wife was killed in an accident 6 months after married. So she was hit by a car. And so I and my 7 year old daughter at the time were alone again. And then I married again in less than 2 years to somebody that I knew already, and I knew her family. She'd been a missionary, seemingly a godly person, and we were married for 20 years, had 4 kids, and then she ran off after 20 years and left me with the kids. All right, so I mean, and the marriage was difficult, but I didn't realize how difficult it was to me because I had a lot of gratification from my children. I mean, I really loved my kids. They were a lot of fun. They were, you know, they were wonderful kids, and my wife was faithful for 20 years. I mean, it's not like she was like my first wife who was having affairs. My last wife was a faithful wife. She was devoted to the children. She didn't have much affection for me, but that was, you know, that was a price I was willing to pay for having a stable home with good kids and all that. And then she ran off, and she's been gone for 7 years. So, and then my children have had some difficulties in their spiritual lives as a result of their mother's leaving, I think. All of my children have had struggles. Some are doing better than others. I believe most of them, if not all of them, are believers today, but I don't know, you know, I know that none of them have the zeal for the things of God that they had back when the marriage was intact and things like that. So I've definitely grieved to see damage done to my children as well as to my marriages. Fortunately, my children have stayed close to me. They all lived with me after their mothers left. Most of them are grown up now, but I see them all the time, and we're very close. But it's still painful. It's still painful to see, first of all, that my children did come from a broken marriage, something I was determined would never happen, and that my children have scars from it. And I know the pain. I know the pain of being in a marriage that's difficult. I know the pain of losing a marriage that you really, I'm not sure if you divorced your husbands or they divorced you. My marriages were difficult, but I would not divorce because I don't believe in divorce. And so at least I came out of it with a fairly clear conscience that I didn't destroy this marriage. But at the same time, you know, suffering with a clean conscience is only a little better than suffering without one. You know, it's still suffering. And how did I get through it? You know, I've actually been asked that. I've talked to a number of people who've been through divorces and they're struggling, and they asked, you know, what I did to manage the situation and get through it so well. I'm not sure how well I have gotten through it, to tell you the truth. I mean, I've come through it with some very serious, some very reluctance to commit again and so forth, which I'd never really had before. I mean, you come out of it and you've got scars. I don't really know what will come ultimately of this in my life, but I do know this, that the first 2 years, I can only really remember very well the most recent one. I feel like I've had 3 lifetimes, and I only remember the most recent one, which is my 20-year marriage where my wife left for no obvious reason, and she didn't ever tell me why she left. She hasn't spoken to me, really. And so what do I make of it? I know the first couple of years, certainly the first year and probably the first 2 years, I was just absolutely crushed. I had to step out of the ministry for the first year just because I couldn't think straight. I mean, I was on the radio for 4 years doing this program up until the day my wife left in 2001 in November, and I just went off the air the same day. Same day she left, I went off the air. I couldn't broadcast. And I didn't go back on the air for a year. And when I did, I wasn't totally, you know, altogether, you know, feeling good and recovered. But I will say, during those two very, very hard years, and each year after that got a little easier to bear, that I did have to struggle. But the thing that pulled me through was definitely I was unwilling to doubt the goodness of God. I mean, people would say, well, why would God have you get married to someone who he knew was going to, you know, leave, and, you know, all this, you know, why would God put you through these various trials? Well, I don't know the answer to that. I didn't know it then, and I'm not sure I know it now. But I do know this, and this is the one thing that's pulling through everything in my life since I was a child, and this is why I asked if you've been a Christian all your life. I have the advantage of having trusted God since I was a child and known him since I was a teenager quite well, and he's been interactive with me in my life for over 40 years, and for that reason I have sort of a, when this happened to me, it wasn't like I was in a universe by myself. I felt like I was alone in terms of human companionship, but I never felt that God was far from me. I never felt that God deserted me. I mean, the Bible says that God is near to those who have a broken heart, and I've known the nearness of God at those times, sometimes in a more powerful way than when I'm not experiencing a broken heart. I don't really want to say I welcome trials, because I'm not trying to invite any more. But I do say that the trials have been precious because they have driven me to God. I think there's two kinds of responses that people can have when they go through pain. One is to hold God, you know, at arm's length and say, now, you know, don't come near me until you can explain why, you know, why you're doing this. I need some good answers here. Which, of course, is innately not trusting God. It's basically saying, God, you know, you did something I don't understand. I'm not sure I believe you're good anymore. I'm not really sure I can trust you, and therefore I'm going to wrestle this out, and if I ever get to a place where I can see some goodness, maybe I'll be on your side again. That's not the way I go. I mean, to me, I just run to God. I think when trials will either make you run to God or run away from God, and I've seen both happen to different people. To me, it's always been, when my trials come, I run to God, and he's there, and he's strong, and he helps, and he's always given me the grace to go through stuff. And I don't know what I did other than that. I mean, I wish I could tell you, here's some steps you can take. But I don't know what I did except to cry out to God. I mean, I walked around the house for a year feeling someone take a big spoon and scraped all the insides out of me. And, you know, I didn't have any emotion, except, of course, maybe the sense that, you know, life seems so meaningless. But I did have confidence in God. That's not an emotion. That was just a determination. I mean, I would say to God, I would say it out loud. Sometimes many times a day, I had to do it for my own sanity. I would say out loud, God, I am your servant. You own me. I don't own myself. Nothing I have is my own, including my problems. My wife and what she's doing right now is your problem, not mine, because I don't own anything, including my own problems. And I'm glad to be your servant. And I'm just going to let you take care of your own problems for your servant. And I would have to say that again and again, because that's just casting all your cares on him, you know, because he cares for you. This works best if you actually have a close relationship with God to begin with, although some people who don't find that they come into a closer relationship with God through such trials. But I can't tell you how I got through it except to say that I just determined I would never accuse God wrongly. I mean, when my second wife was killed, I mean, as soon as they told me she was dead, I said out loud, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. I wasn't happy about her dying, but I knew that God is good and that God has every right to do with me whatever he wants to. And I honestly have felt that although I've gone through some pretty, you know, grinding trials, I honestly truly think this. I'm not trying to be fake, humble, or pious, or anything like that. I feel that I have suffered less than what I deserve. I frankly believe that although I've been a true Christian almost all my life, I feel like I've let God down many, many times. I'm certainly far from perfect, and I think of my imperfections. I think, you know, God, you've let me off the hook so many times that, you know, what's happening to me right now, I don't see it as a direct result of anything I've done wrong, but hey, I've done plenty of things wrong I didn't suffer for. And, you know, you don't owe me any explanations, God. You don't owe me any explanations. What I deserve is to die and go to hell. That's what I deserve. And so since I'm not going to do that, because I'm not going to go to hell, I'd say that whatever else happens to me is a lot better than what I deserve. And that's the perspective you have to have, because that's truth. The truth will make you free. I'm not saying you do this to play some mind games with yourself to try to, deceive yourself into thinking all is well. I'm saying this is the truth. God is good. We don't deserve better than what we get, no matter how bad it is. And, we see other people who deserve good things less than we do, and yet they get good things. And we say, well, how come they get a happy marriage, or how come they get this or that? But that's not the way to think about it. They've got their own trials. Everyone's got their own set of trials. You belong to Jesus. He will give you the trials that he thinks will be good for you. And I will tell you this. The first couple of years after the last divorce, I really remember saying, God, I know that everything's going to work together for good, but I just can't imagine how this at all could ever be good. I just can't see how this could be good. But I believe you. I believe it will be, but I just can't see how it's going to be. I wasn't doubting. I was just saying, hey, this is, it's a total mystery to me how this could ever be good. And as I look back at it now, of course, it's been 7 years, I see some good that's come from it. Not as much as I will someday, perhaps. And, of course, the last chapter has not been written. But I do believe in a God who is infinitely good and infinitely powerful and does all things well. And even the things that are painful to me, if he wants me to go through that, I embrace that. I want that. I want whatever he wants, because that's just part of the chiseling. That's part of the shaping of a man or a woman of God. God has to bring the trials, and I accept them. And it's always been good for me to accept them. It's always brought me closer to God. And I will say this, that, of course, as some years have passed, I do see now, I think, well, I thought it was the worst thing in the world when my wife left, me and the kids. But my kids and I now think, there was something that could have been worse. She could have stayed in the way she was. Because, not to put her down. I don't mean to put her down, but she has not gotten better in the 7 years. She's, if anything, she's not only continued to be the kind of person she was in the marriage, but she's had, it looks to me like things have gotten worse. And I think, well, God maybe knew. Maybe God knew. Certainly God knew that this was going to happen, and maybe he knew it would be much worse for me 7 years down the line, still married to her. Because, if she had gone the way she's gone in her life, I would not divorce her. God knows that. God knows I would not divorce my wife for any reason, because I don't believe in divorce. But God mercifully put it in her heart to divorce me. And it didn't seem merciful at the time, but I can see now that the kind of way she's gone with her life, if she was still my wife, I'd be more miserable, far more miserable than I am right now. I'm not miserable now, just somber sometimes. Anyway, Sister Sharon, the answer in these situations is Jesus. You get closer to Jesus, and you'll get better. Circumstances might not get better, but you'll get better, and that's what God has in mind. And as far as your daughter's concerned, I sorrow for you because she's gone the wrong direction, but she's not dead yet. Keep praying for her. It says in 1 John, if you see someone who's sinned but not unto death, ask God, pray for them, and he'll give them life. For those who do not sin unto death. Your daughter has not sinned unto death yet. Keep praying. Keep hopeful. And don't give up. Hard situation you're in. I know very well. But I also know that it's like what Corrie Ten Boom's sister said. No matter how deep the pit you're in, Jesus is deeper still. Let's talk to Craig, who's calling from Round Rock, Texas, next. Craig, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Well, that was a pretty hard call to follow up. And
I feel sorry for you.
Yeah, that's deep stuff, Aaron. It's a hard move for that woman and for you.
Yeah.
The situation. My question may seem pretty silly and trivial in comparison, but I just recently had been listening to Kenneth Gentry. I know you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
With him, because I was first introduced to the preterist position of revelation by your teaching, and I was very much persuaded by that after studying the scripture about it. And so I started listening to some of his teaching, and I noticed there were a little bit of differences. I know he's post-millennial.
Certainly.
But beyond that, not really taking that into account, but I noticed that I guess he's pretty sure that the man of sin in chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians is Nero.
Mm, yeah, I'm sure that's his view. Yeah, it's not mine.
Okay. Well, I was wondering if you could, because he consequently, because he believes it's Nero, he also believes that chapter 1 is not the second coming of Christ, but chapter 1 of Thessalonians 2 is also about 70 A.D.
Right. I think he and Gary DeMar do the same things with those chapters. They move a little closer to full preterism than I do. I still see a lot of passages in the Bible as being about the future second coming of Christ, the resurrection of the dead, and all of that. And I think the man of sin, just as I understand all the factors in interpreting 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, together with what I think Paul was alluding to, which was Daniel chapter 7, I have to see the man of sin the same way the Reformers did. And that was that the man of sin would rise up after the fall of the Roman Empire, which did happen, and that was that which rose up in the church. See, I mean, Paul says the man of sin would sit in the temple of God. Now, Nero never sat in the temple of God. Whether we take the temple of God to be the Jewish temple, although we might say that the Roman troops, after his death, did intrude into the temple.
Are you familiar with Gentry's explanation of that?
No, I actually am not. I've not read him
he
on that.
He says that, you know, where it says that the passage, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, the phrase so that he sits in the Greek, the tense of the verbs, or, you know, I'm no Greek scholar by any means, but it actually implies intention, not something that actually was accomplished. And he says it's the same thing used in, like, Luke 4, where the Pharisees, so they tried to take Jesus and throw him over the hill, you know, they chased him so that they might throw him over the hill, and the same phrase is used there. It speaks of intention. So this is a kind of a translation.
Yeah, I have not read him on that, and he's more of a scholar than I am, but I think sometimes even scholars have points they want to prove, and they'll take maybe unlikely interpretations of certain passages because it'll fit better. I'm not accusing him of that.
Yeah, you never.
I'm just saying.
Okay.
No, I've only read him on I've read him on a couple of issues, the Olivet Discourse and the dating of Revelation primarily, and I've heard him teach one time, I think. But what I was going to say is that the temple of God, I believe, is the church. That's the term that Paul uses for the church elsewhere. In 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, he refers to the church as the temple of God. And so the man of sin, I believe, has got to be one who sits in the temple of God, or even, if we could say, intends to sit and portray himself as God in the temple of God. I'm not sure that Nero did that in the church. But anyway, I take the whole argument that the Reformers used to identify the man of sin as the papacy, as an argument that's got many, many prongs, and all of them seem to be valid. I think that trying to force Nero into that is like, you have to use a shoehorn for that.
Mm. Okay.
But I'm not trying to disrespect Kenneth Gentry. Sure. He's a better scholar than I am about many things, I'm sure, but I just have a different opinion on the Thessalonian correspondence.
Do you know about the Emperor Claudius? You know, he says that Claudius...
Yes, he intended...
Strainer.
Right. Oh, no, I didn't know it meant that, but I know that Claudius actually did decree that an image of himself would be put in the temple in Jerusalem, but he was assassinated before it happened.
Oh, I thought it was Caligula.
No, I think... Oh, you're right. I'm sorry, it is Caligula. Claudius didn't do that. Excuse me.
Yeah, so Claudius, actually, he says in the Greek, Claude, it means restrain, so his name is actually Restrainer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it says, letting him who now restrains, so his idea is that he was
preventing Nero. Mm-hmm.
Right, Nero from coming to power once he was done away with his wife, poisoned him, then Nero.
Well, I would recommend that all of my listeners that are interested in the subject get Gentry's stuff and read it and see how good the arguments are.
Yeah, I need to dig into that. I just saw. I guess I'm kind of lazy. I figured I'd call you first.
Okay, yeah, I haven't read him. But was it videos of him, or was it books of his that you read this?
Oh, I just found some MP3s online that I just put on my player. Gotcha. And listened to in the car.
Kenneth Gentry is a good man, and I don't agree with that at this point. Maybe I'll listen to his arguments and see if there's merit in it.
Okay. Well,
okay,
I just want to say real quick, you know, if your children are ever listening, that, you know, many are greatly blessed by what, you know, the work God has done in your life, and you've definitely been a blessing in my life, as I've just kind of pulled away to some degree from the institutional church at this point in our life, that having such sound teaching from somebody who the Spirit just witnesses to me is desiring to do the will of God, whether perfect or not, I just know that your desires are pure, and that means a lot to a lot of people. So I just want to.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
God bless you, brother. I appreciate your call.
You too.
Bye now. Okay, I hope I have time for more than one caller, but we're almost out of time. Michael from Portland, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. I want to be very short. Just a very tough question, and I don't want to keep you long. Probably you want to get the other caller. I have a very deep faith, and I don't think anything can destroy my faith in God, in Jesus.
Uh-huh.
That being said, I was studying many other subjects, not only relating to theology or scripture. I found a good, I don't know if this is the right word, very sincere Christians who believe in evolution. Now, my faith will not be destroyed if tomorrow or in a year or 10 years somehow will be enough evidence for the evolution. Evolution has a lot of gaps, as you know better than me probably. Now, is there any wrongdoing if, let's say, the evolution will prove that was an evolution, and many people believe that at one point in time when the man become real man, then we'll start with Adam forward. But could be possible that will be an evolution. Will affect our Christian life if, let's say, evolution is right?
Some people think it would. It wouldn't change my life. I mean, if evolution could be proven to be true, I mean, proven. It's not even come close to being proven.
Right.
But if it was proven to be true, I would simply have to say, okay, I guess I've interpreted Genesis 1 differently than it was intended to be understood, which is entirely possible. I've had to change my interpretation on many things in Scripture because better data came in than what I had before. I don't believe that evolution is true in the sense of common descent of all species from a common ancestor. I don't believe that that is true, and I don't think it'll ever be proven to be true. Everybody believes in what we call microevolution. I mean, even the staunchest six-day young Earth creationists believe that, small-time evolution occurs within a species. Unfortunately, secularists and those who are not Christians extrapolate from that and say, well, that's how all species came into existence in the first place. And, of course, there's not the slightest proof of that. It's just a claim. It's just a philosophical claim. I believe it's a wrong philosophical claim. But if it was true, I will say this. Evolution does contradict, obviously, a literal interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. And therefore, if evolution is somehow managed to prove beyond question that evolution is true, which, again, I can't even imagine they would, but if they did, all that would prove is that Genesis 1 is not to be taken quite literally. But that would not be the end of the world. It certainly wouldn't affect any faith in God or in Jesus. It would simply affect my own confidence in my ability to discern when a passage is to be taken literally or not. Because lots of passages in the Bible are not to be taken literally. There's parables. There's, apocalyptic literature. Yeah, there's songs. There's all kinds of poetry. Lots of things in the Bible are not to be taken literally. It is my judgment that Genesis 1 is to be taken literally. But if I had to change my mind, it wouldn't change my faith in God or in Christ.
That's right. Thank you so much, Steve.
All right. Thanks for calling, Michael. And I'm sorry to Christopher, my atheist friend in Portland, who's waiting, and I'd love to talk to you today. I hope you call Monday because we're out of time today, and it would be very good to talk with you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you want to help us pay our radio bills, we've got someone who's willing to double your gift that you give in the month of December, so any gift of yours is double the value. If you want to contribute, you write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's our mailing address. You can find that address at our website. You can also find a PayPal link at our website. And if you don't want to give us any money at all, you can still go to our website and get a whole bunch of stuff that's all free there. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. I hope you have a great weekend, and call in or at least listen in Monday, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.